In 2016, EFCA pastors and church leaders gathered in Des Moines, Iowa for the annual theology conference. The focus of the post-conference was on the theme, the ministry of the gospel and gender dysphoria. On this episode of the podcast, we share the second message from Mark Yarhouse, Gender Dysphoria, Scientific, Biological, Psychological, and Sociocultural Considerations. Mark is the Hughes Endowed Chair and Professor of Psychology at Regent University in Virginia Beach, Virginia, where he is a core faculty member in the doctoral program in clinical psychology. Mark is also the founding director of the Institute for the Study of Sexual Identity.
The visual that I want to give you here is someone who experiences gender incongruence, so their gender identity does not line up with their biological sex, or what you'll hear is, you know, their birth sex. Sometimes you'll hear people say they're assigned sex, and I would only use that language with people with intersex conditions where it's an ambiguous genitalia and they're assigning the sex at birth. I don't usually use that with transgender and gender dysphoric people, even though my field does. You'll see, in my own manual of making a diagnosis, you see that that's the way they would like you to use that language. I don't find that to be accurate. It's not an arbitrary assignment. There is nothing for someone who's gender dysphoric, there's no outward sign of that dysphoria at birth. So to call it assigned as though it were arbitrary, I think is misleading to the public. I mentioned that this gender incongruence, at least when you think of transgender, that's an umbrella term for a number of experiences. So when I say MTF, I'm saying biological male who experiences themselves as female, FTM, a biological female who presents or experiences themselves as male, cross-dressers, which is the more current term for more of a transvestic presentation, cross-dressing for the purpose of sexual arousal. Drag queens and drag kings are cross-dressing for entertainment. Transsexual persons for whom there is a enduring cross-gender identification, usually through hormonal treatment and sex reassignment surgery. Intersex persons we've talked about quite a bit. Now, this community doesn't even agree on who should be in this umbrella. I mean, when I sent my book out for review, several reviewers said, throw them out. They shouldn't be there. They're not in there. This is the broadest umbrella you're going to see of transgender. And I've tried to just say, you know, broadly speaking, all these people make a case for themselves being transgender. I'm not going to throw them out. I'll tell the reader and you can decide. But within the community, they don't agree on who's in there. So that's interesting. What causes this? We don't know. Probably the most popular theory right now is called the brain sex theory, which the idea is we know that during prenatal development, a fetus will, if it's going to be masculinized, that'll happen in terms of the genitalia at one point in the prenatal history, prenatally in the first few months. And then later, the mind will map towards male. And so the brain will map towards male. And so these distinctions occur at different stages prenatally. The argument is it possible that just by variation that occurs over time in nature, that the genitalia map one direction and the brain maps a different direction? Maybe it's one every 11,000, but maybe that happens. You know, maybe that's what's going on. So it's called the brain sex theory. And the research on that is usually done, the most often cited would be studies of regions of the brain in post-mortem where they look at transsexual people who are male to female, and they look at regions of that their brain and compare it to males and females who are not transsexual. And they look to see if these regions are statistically significantly more like these regions of these types of brains. And they have found in very small samples, they have seen that to be the case. The problem, there's a couple problems with this, is that you're looking at very small sample size. You're looking at people who have used hormones of the opposite sex and had surgeries, and those hormones and the way that they wash over these areas can actually affect this part of the brain that you're studying for size. You are studying for size. You're talking about morphology, the structures of these things. Are the size of the structure, are they different? And that's a pretty rough way to say that's the cause. You know, I don't know. And we're also talking about a region of the brain that we're talking about identity. Like, if I were to say to you, I want to do a study of your brain to find out if you're an animal rights activist or a Republican or a Democrat, like, it's an identity. It's very challenging to say this is the part of the brain where I could say you're this by identity. I mean, would it involve parts of the frontal lobe, the parietal lobe, the temporal? I mean, what all would be involved in that, let alone this little area of the hypothalamus? So I'm not against the theory. It's an interesting one to me, but I don't see enough evidence that would say to me, here's the cause, okay? Others look at elevated rates of other concerns, like childhood abuse for people who end up experiencing gender dysphoria. Of course, most people who are abused don't experience gender dysphoria, whether it's physical abuse or sexual abuse. So that's harder to get at, here's the causal pathway. I've certainly met with children as young as 6 and have done family histories with them. Some families are pretty disrupted and have difficulties in their history. Other families, nothing noteworthy. And yet this child is gender dysphoric, meaning they're presenting as the other sex, and there doesn't appear to be anything in their family history that would point to an explanation for it. That doesn't mean it's biological or genetic or, you know, whatever. I just don't know, you know, at that moment. So I don't know that we'll ever know the cause of this, but it is being presented as primarily the brain sex theory. It's very popular right now. If I'm a pastor, I'm going to take the posture of we don't know. I might say to someone under my shepherding, what would it mean for you to know? I think that's a much more instructive question that gets at rich information than coming up with kind of a culture war posture where you say, it can't be this or it can't be that or, you know, something like that. That's where many conservatives have gone, at least with the homosexual debate. Someone says, well, I didn't choose this. I was born this way. And then conservatives say, no, you weren't born this way. Like, I mean, there's just a point of diminishing returns in pastoral care that sort of lock horns around those issues. So I just find saying, what would it mean for you to know? I think the best science here is still unclear as to a definitive answer for causation, particularly when you look at the umbrella of all the different expressions I just said could be transgender. The only one that we have data on that I just pointed to was transsexuality, where someone did cross-gender identity, hormonal treatment, and so on and so forth, and that's not the most common experience. And you're going to say the limited data we have on that tells you causal pathways for this? We just don't know. So I usually enter into that with humility. We just don't know. What would it mean for you to know? And then we go from there. I'm also going to encourage us to take a developmental perspective, and this is probably where I have a little bit of an advantage, is that I've seen people at 5 and 6 years of age, 15 years of age, 25 years of age, 65 years of age, I've seen transgender people at each of those ages. So when I run into someone who's 65, 55, 45, and they're presenting as the other sex and they don't really pass that well, you could have in your mind as a pastor, that's what it means to be transgender. It's helped me to see that person at age 6 in my mind. If I'm out for coffee with them, I wonder what life's been like since they were 6 years old. Because I've seen kids that age. So I'm going to take a lifespan perspective a little bit on this. When we look at gender dysphoria in childhood, an estimated 75% of cases actually resolve before that child reaches adulthood. That's an interesting finding. Now, there are critics right now who are criticizing those studies that have suggested that. It's been anywhere from 60 to 90%. I put 75 as, a reasonable average, 75 to 80% of diagnosable cases of gender dysphoria resolving by the time that child reaches late adolescence, adulthood. In other words, if you just wait, in most cases, this resolves on its own. Now, critics are saying they're not all diagnosed the same. There's different presentations. True gender dysphoria will always be there. In other words, there's a desire to make it sort of an essential aspect of personhood. This is a transgender child when it continues. And when you're not diagnosing it right, you're going to get it resolving. If it resolved, it was never transgender. I'm getting that argument in my field right now. Maybe. But the data we have so far suggests that in the vast majority of cases, it resolves on its own. And what we call those desisters. It desists. And we compare those to persisters, people for whom this persists. So here's just one example of a study of children who for whom this persisted or desisted. And I give you this sort of idea of these are the age ranges. The upper group is the persister from about age 5 of indifference around these issues, cross-gender identification around ages 6 to 7. Very similar with those who desisted, with those who with that cross-gender identification, one of the distinctions is for those who persisted, they felt that they were the other sex, and the other group wished they were the other sex. When I interview adults looking back, sometimes they say, I knew I was a boy. And others will say, I was a girl. I am a girl. We use language like that. That's one thing you sometimes listen for when you're talking with people about these experiences. The cross-gender identity, the dysphoria itself, either increases or decreases roughly around ages 10 or 10 to 13 in the group that were desisted. So that was interesting. And they either, for the one group, I have here social environment, anticipating puberty, falling in love, things like that. For both groups, puberty feels like it will be a nightmare. Because your body is confirming something that, in a sense, is undeniable, right? You are biologically male or female, and your body confirms it by going through puberty. And people who have gender dysphoria fear this greatly. It's pretty anxiety-producing. Interestingly, for those for whom this resolved, it was going through puberty that seemed to help them. It wasn't as bad as they thought it was going to be. And they actually help them gather a sense of their gender identity on the other side of puberty. For those for whom this persisted, it was as bad as they thought. It was awful. And that's something I think to be sensitive to. I'm sensitive to both as we anticipate it, but I am waiting to see how will they experience this, because I don't know on the front. I can't predict on the front end, will this help resolve things or will this make things worse? This has led to an intervention for some to actually delay puberty. So I give you four different sort of pathways here. There's efforts to decrease cross-gender identification. There's watchful waiting. There's suppressing puberty. And there's facilitating cross-gender identification. This is what people in my field do, okay? Of these, the one that's actually controversial is the first one. Decreasing cross-gender identification is thought to be more controversial. And it's probably because you only hear from people for whom this persists. And they would say to you, when I was a kid, when people tried to resolve this in keeping with my biological sex, it was traumatizing to me. And that may be accurate. I don't doubt what they're saying, but I think parents, meaning well, tried to resolve this with their child's biological sex, their birth sex, and they tried to resolve it, and this dysphoria never went away. And that child, now an adult looking back, says, that was horrible for me. Okay, that's concerning to me. Okay, I don't know what to suggest about that, but sometimes parents do very mean well, but can do things that are pretty traumatizing to a kid. Verbally, I've known of parents to say some pretty awful things to a boy when the boy is gender dysphoric, okay, about what it means to be a man, about, what you know, toughen up, about things like that. It's pretty shaming to a kid who's 6 or 7. I don't think we ever hear from people for whom this resolves on its own. So it's a little hard to know what to make of the adults for whom this persisted, other than they tell us, this was pretty harmful to me. Watchful waiting is popular in the sense that if you just wait, this will probably resolve for most people. Let's just wait and be... Now, what technically this means is you try to be as neutral as possible to a child who's expressing their gender identity. But it's very hard as a parent to raise a child and be gender neutral. Like, most gifts they get, most clothing they have has some sort of a gender connection to it, right? So it's harder than it sounds like. Puberty suppression should be thought of as just buying time. What the intervention is here is you block them from going into puberty around age 10, and you wait till about 15 or 16, and then that child, now a teenager, decides, am I going to pursue my gender identity associated with my birth sex, or am I going to pursue a cross-gender identification? It's not, in my view, meant to be a vote either direction. It is giving a child more time because it's hard to make that call at age 10. Now, if you're saying to yourself, that's not a call anybody should be making at that age, I hear you. I'm concerned about that too. And in some jurisdictions, it's now, there's a lot that's being put in the hands of children, teenagers, without even parental notification, and sometimes even in this area, which is concerning to me as well. And then there's things parents can do that would facilitate cross-gender identification through clothing and hairstyle and things like that, names. And those are also things that people do when a child is gender dysphoric. My point at the bottom here is to say that every child is still going to need help with their family relationships, their own sense of their walk with God, a corporate faith community, healthy ways to cope. And that's where I put most of my energy in my role as a psychologist, is trying to help the family with it at that end. I was part of a group that was giving recommendations to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Association on this. I think the question with minors is there any protocol, is there any therapy, is there any counseling that does better than just waiting to see if this resolves? Remember I said a 75 to 80% resolution on its own? There is no therapy you can offer that gives you a better outcome than that. I don't know of any therapy that makes it even better than 75%. Waiting to see if it resolves on its own is probably the most effective strategy in that sense. That's not on its own reported as harmful by adults, nor is it better than doing some kind of an intervention. There's no interventions that I'm familiar with. I've seen a couple published, but the data on the outcomes are not any better than what you get with just watching to see. So they recommended focusing on that child and their sense of their identity, their sense of self, not really having an agenda for how this resolves, giving them support, helping their faith community be supportive of this child. I think it's more complicated than they make it sound, but I understand what they're trying to do. Now, once this reaches late adolescence, adulthood, let me say a little bit about that. It does not tend to resolve on its own. I've read a couple of case studies where it resolved on its own. It does not tend to. For some reason, when it does resolve on its own, the person identifies as gay or lesbian or bisexual about 75% of the time. We don't understand the connection between those two things. Because this is not about sexuality and sexual orientation. Gender identity is about their gender identity, their experience of themselves as a man or a woman, as male or female. So that's their gender identity. But when it resolves on its own, naturally, that child, now an adult, does tend to be gay, lesbian, or bisexual for reasons we don't fully understand. I give you four pathways here, and one's not really a path. They drop out of treatment, and nobody knows what happens to them. If you want to call that a path, okay, we'll call it a path. I don't know what happens to them. Others resolve it in accordance with their biological sex. Others engage in cross-dressing behavior intermittently. They might do it privately by wearing, like I know women I've known who have worn male boxer shorts. And by wearing male boxer shorts, it takes the edge off the gender dysphoria. So they cross-dress privately. Others cross-dress publicly, but in places that are different than their hometown. Like in my area of Virginia Beach, they might drive to Richmond or Washington, D.C., and they cross-dress publicly to take the edge off the dysphoria but they wouldn't do it in their own home community. Okay? Others maybe on the weekends, something like that, once a month, something along those lines. And then the fourth path is to adopt a cross-gender role, which may include hormonal treatment and sex reassignment surgery. My point at the bottom is, again, they're all going to need, if they're in my church or they're visiting my church, part of my community, they're going to need social support, family relationships, someone to help shepherd them in their personal faith, their corporate faith community involvement, coping activities, and so on and so forth. Or they may be visiting and they want to explore, what would it look like for me to be a part of your faith community? Or maybe they come to know Christ in your faith community and they're somewhere on this path, these paths. So part of what I do is I'm asking, how is the conflict experienced by the person, right? That's the fundamental question for the person experiencing this gender incongruence. How is it experienced by them? What does my experience of gender dysphoria mean to me? I mentioned purposes of cross-dressing. This is part of what I'm trying to get at when I meet with somebody. Is it for expression? Some people will say, I'm just expressing who I really am. Other people will say, I'm managing a dysphoria that feels life-threatening. Other people will say arousal. And still other people would say entertainment. So I'm trying to get a sense. What I wouldn't want pastors to do is to think that cross-dressing is for arousal. In rare instances, it can be for that. Those folks, in my view, are often not coming to see me for help with that. It's their fetish, and they're doing it unless it's caused a problem in their marriage, or they've been caught, or something along those lines. They're not usually coming to see me, and they usually have very mixed motivations for seeing someone. People who do it for entertainment, again, not usually going to come and get pastoral care, not usually going to come in. This is their weekend job. This is what they do. Many are heterosexual. It's more, the dysphoria is more the management part or the expression of my true self part. In fact, one person who met with me, I was working with him and his wife, and he was gender dysphoric. He did tend to use that language. I'm expressing my true self. I've been masquerading as a male for 30 years, 40 years, and I am done with it. I'm going to be who I am. Okay, so expressing true self. I often used the language of managing your dysphoria because that's how I view it. This dysphoria is so strong that the only way you feel like this works is for you to be expressive in this way. I don't find that language as helpful. I was respectful to him. That was his language. But his wife was not keen on that language either. What do you mean? You don't know who you... I've been married to you for 30 years. What is it? What do you mean that you're not being your true self? What does that mean about our marriage? What does that mean about our children? What does it mean about you as a father? Right? There's all these cascade of implications when you say, I need to express my true self. What has it meant? Who have you been all these years? And she liked my language a little bit better too, the idea of you're managing dysphoria that is causing you great distress. And he got that. He saw that as like the language of a psychologist. You probably have to talk about me that way. I don't have to, but many of my colleagues wouldn't, but that's how I experienced it. I look at what is the storyline that emerges from the transgender community. And I'm going to talk about here in a little bit, because I think the primary storyline is that of a culture to be celebrated. And what is the primary storyline that comes from your faith community? And this comes back to you as a pastor. You set this tone. What is the story you want to tell about people navigating these issues in their life? What's your ministry brand to those on the margins in a culture that's rapidly changing to celebrating this group as a community that's part of a diverse and pluralistic culture? The challenge for the pastor is, what will my ministry brand be in that changing culture to a group of people who are now in the culture wars? And my biggest concern in pastoral care is what happens to people on the margins who are just navigating gender identity conflicts. They're not activists. They're not trying to deconstruct norms around sex and gender. They're trying to survive. What will pastoral care look like for them? So we did interviews a few years ago of 32 biological males whose gender identity was female. And this was the first study of its kind. It was kind of interesting that way. And I honestly, I wasn't sure they were Christians when I first did the study. I just didn't know. I didn't know, how did that work? How does faith function in the life of someone like this? So I asked like 3 or 4 questions in our interviews to confirm that these were Christians. And I have never heard such a testimony as their responses. In fact, I was sharing this at the Virginia Psychological Association, and I've never shared the gospel as clearly to a group of psychologists as I did answering their responses. I mean, it was things that you would say. Jesus is my Savior, is my Lord and Savior. He's the atoning work of Jesus makes it possible for me to have a relationship with the Father. I mean, all these kinds of like things that evangelicals would say were the data. So I'm presenting it at the Virginia Psychological Association. It was pretty fun. But I don't usually get to share the gospel at my profession. So there I was. Boom. Who knew it would be transgender Christians who would be ushering this in? So I give you the milestones here. The average age of awareness was 6 of cross-dressing behavior, atypical play. Internal confusion around 11 because of the consequences of that. Most kids don't come to see me at 5 or 6. They come to see me at 6 or 7 when they start preschool or kindergarten, because families will sort of see this as a phase the kid will go through. They're not that concerned about what their family thinks about it. You know, we all love each other. But once their peer group is involved, kindergarten, preschool, then families usually come to see someone to check it out. Okay, external consequences, thoughts and reasoning, like something's wrong with me, need to do research, wanted to be female, attempts to address the conflict. And by the way, the average age here they became Christians was 23. It's a little older than you normally see in research. They sought counseling, cross-dressing behavior, average age of 27. And then disclosure, the first time they shared with somebody was to their spouse. Can you imagine? At 35. Now, this was an older sample. I'm doing another study right now of younger Christians who are transgender. But I've worked with a number of people in this age range, 35 and older, and those marriages don't usually make it. They can. I know some who have, but they're really difficult waters to navigate. And then average age of 47, only 11 of 32 said there has been no resolution. This is an enduring condition for me. Others sought assistance from other people. Only 9 had transitioned. Again, not that common to transition. Others sought acceptance or came to accept themselves as this is who I am, this is what I experience. Here's a couple of quotes from them. Well, I've certainly been through periods of why me, God, and I've been through periods where I'd like to have attended worship services and femme or as a female. I've refrained from doing so as not to be disruptive of the spirit of reverence. There have been times when I prayed that God would take away my cross-dressing inclinations. I finally accepted the answer was no. It's an interesting way to frame things in my view. I shall work out my salvation with fear and trembling as I'm in the process of being perfected. Either way, I believe that God sees me through Christ and my hope is in his righteousness, not my own. So I want to give you an image that might help you in pastoral care to think of the person navigating gender identity in the center, and then you have the local faith community, their family, their friends, the mental health community, the transgender community, and I want to state the obvious, I guess. You have the cultural context in which this is occurring, right? The cultural context is one in which standards and norms around sex and gender are eroding or being toppled. That's the culture. So your ministry setting is happening in that cultural context. Now, I work with churches in Southern California, the Pacific Northwest. There are areas of the country where this discussion's a few years ahead, and there's areas of the country where they're catching up with where the culture's going. You know what I'm talking about, right? So I don't know where all of you are, depending on where you are, you're experiencing that cultural erosion of norms around sex and gender differently. Some are pretty far along in their setting, others are not quite there, but it is occurring. I mentioned the transgender community is quite broad. I wanted to say something about the mental health community. This is my field. The mental health and medical health and legal considerations trending in support of cross-gender identification. In fact, in the most recent diagnostic manual that we use to make diagnoses, it's no longer an identity issue. It used to be called gender identity disorder because it was the identity that was the problem. And you may be saying, sounds like it's the identity that's the concern today. The way that the field has shifted is they made it a dysphoria rather than the identity, meaning, is it distressing to you? It reminds me of what happened in the 70s with homosexuality. It used to be that homosexuality was a mental health concern, and then it was whether it was ego dystonic. Was it upsetting to you to have same-sex attractions? And then ultimately it was removed. I think that's happening right now. I think it used to be a gender identity concern, and today it's a dysphoria. Is it distressing to you? If it's not, it's not a diagnosable concern. It's an emerging gender identity. It's something along those lines. So I don't think you're going to have the mental health community in all cases as a resource. Maybe you've never felt like you have in some of these discussions. But for those for whom it is distressing, it can be life-threateningly distressing. So I want to be careful there. I wouldn't want you to pastor everybody the same way. It takes time and energy to really understand what's going on with this person. The other thing about the mental health community is that we've also said you could lose the diagnosis if you transition. In fact, they sort of presume you will get hormonal treatment and surgery. I think that's a mistake. People have been gender dysphoric throughout history and across cultures. We're just, as a culture, understanding what it looks like today in our culture. And so people have been dealing with this with no hormonal treatment and no surgeries for many years and many cultures, right? So that's a historically relatively new phenomenon. Not new in our culture. It's been going on for quite a while here and in the Netherlands. But to treat it as though historically it's the preferred outcome is just not historically accurate. It's not the case. What I look for in a mental health professional is someone who's not got an agenda. Now, this is hard. I know. Even in my own community, there's only two or three of us who do work in this area, and one has a reputation for essentially transitioning people, moving people along. I'm probably known more for laying out what's available and helping someone make a decision in light of a number of considerations. And I think good mental health professionals should do that and always treat the co-occurring issue, meaning these folks often have high rates of depression, suicidality, anxiety disorders. I always treat those things first. I don't want someone making major decisions about hormones and surgery in a state of depression, a state of an anxiety disorder. I want those things treated. I'm impressed with how many of my colleagues will just transition people. And the data suggests even when you do that, those other things are still present. So let's treat those things. And then let's consider what's the best step after that. Then I think the person's making better informed decisions. Then there's also, what is the degree of incongruence and the capacity to cope with it? And what does my gender dysphoria mean to me? Now, this brings up two other frameworks. Remember I shared with you at the end of the first talk, I shared with you an integrity framework. That lays the theological foundation for me as a Christian for understanding differences intended from creation between males and females. But there are two other frameworks I'd like to at least introduce you to. So the second one is, I call a disability framework. Now, disability, can be thought of in a couple of ways. Some Christians have said to me, you're still doing the integrity framework, but you're saying now it's part of the fall. That's not what I'm saying. There are non-Christians who would see this as a disability, meaning it has no theological anchor point for these folks. They just see it as a normal variation. It occurs in nature over time, but the subject that you're caring for is not functioning properly as a result of a normal variation. Maybe it occurs in 1 in 11,000 cases, but something's not functioning properly. It is morally neutral. It has no reference point to right and wrong. Just nature did not run its course in the way that it normally does. So rather than the whatever ability is supposed to be there, whatever alignment is supposed to be there, there's a misalignment. There's a disability. So it identifies these concerns as reflections of a non-moral variation in nature. Now, as a Christian, when I look at the disability framework, I tend to look at it as the result of the fall, that you have that as a possibility over time. And in that sense, it's likened more to a disability, which is a non-moral reality for this person. This person is not morally culpable for experiencing gender dysphoria. I met with a 16-year-old who came to me with her parents who did not know what to do with their teenager who was saying she was gender dysphoric. They had met with three pastors before they had come to see me, and each of them said, this gender dysphoria is willful disobedience. And that was the category that they had handy to them to talk with them. Now, I never really know when someone says, I met with a pastor and this is what they told me. I really give you the benefit of the doubt. I don't know what exactly the pastor said to them. I'm sometimes afraid what people say I say to them. You know, I don't know what's being said. So I give people a great deal of benefit of the doubt here. But the impression was that the person talking to them thought this was willful disobedience, that the person had somehow chosen to experience this dysphoria as sort of a claim against their family and their faith and the things that they believed in. I have never met anybody who chose to experience gender dysphoria. I'm talking about the distress associated with this incongruence can be really, really remarkably strong, and it's not chosen. Now, you have choices to make, right? So to me, the question is, what is volitional in all of this? What is volitional? But I don't think the person chose to experience this dysphoria as they experienced this at a very young age. Now, I wanted to also mention the third lens. The third lens is really where the rest of the culture is rapidly moving toward. This is what I call diversity. And this really comes out of the multicultural movement and an understanding that the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community has emerged as a culture. And I think that's undeniable. It has emerged as a culture. I'm writing a chapter on what is a culture and what are the arguments for it being a culture, what are the concerns that critics would have. Is that an accurate way to think of the LGBT community? But it's undeniable, I think, that in our culture, it has emerged, in our society, it has emerged as its own culture, broadly defined. So the rest of the culture is not in a place of an integrity framework. It's not drawing on scripture. It's not drawing on creation accounts. It's not looking at creation, fall, redemption, glorification. Nor does it see this as a disability, a non-moral reality to be addressed with compassion. Maybe some do. The culture is moving rapidly towards saying, this is an area of diversity to be celebrated. We're a community of like-minded people, like-experienced people. So not things that aren't functioning properly, but signaling a different type of person. And in the transgender community, there was the development of the word cisgender to account for people who are not transgender. And so a cisgender person is someone for whom their biological sex aligns with their gender identity. So if you're not gender dysphoric or transgender broadly, you are cisgender. And what they were trying to do was create a category so that those in the majority didn't get to name everybody else in the minority. You are also named, right? And we are categorically different types of people, all right? Now, I would use that. I'm not saying that for us to... I want to be careful here. I'm not saying that for us to have... I don't want to have fun with that. I really want us to think strategically about how you respond as pastors to that reality. You minister in a sociocultural context where that has emerged as a reality from a community of people who say, we are a culture to be celebrated. I would imagine the pastoral challenges facing you are going to be remarkable. Because you don't draw on a diversity framework, at least I don't. I draw on, I'll talk with you about how you draw on all three, but my foundation is with the integrity framework theologically. But to be wise in our culture, you have to realize how the other two function, and is there anything of value from either of the other ones? So I gave you here on the slide a strong form of the diversity framework and a weak form of it. The strong form is more of an academic, philosophical, theological debate. And it has to do with, it comes out of Foucault and Judith Butler, and it essentially says that sex and gender are one more of many sources of authority that oppress people. And every source of authority needs to be contested, needs to be deconstructive. And so, yeah, maybe gender identity is more socially constructed. We will see you as a source of authority that's oppressive, but so is biological sex. And biological sex can now be deconstructed. In fact, Judith Butler says as much in this quote, "If the immutable character of sex is contested, perhaps this construct called sex is as culturally constructed as gender. Indeed, perhaps it was always already gender, with the consequences that the distinction between sex and gender turns out to be no distinction at all." In other words, there are voices from Foucault forward who want to say that this is arbitrary and constructed, and it's a source of oppression, and it needs to be deconstructed. So when a pastor comes in and says, "I adhere to the integrity framework," guess what? You're one more source of oppression. You say, "Well, I just appeal to nature, to the biology of it." Another source of oppression. Like, it just cascades from there. They're all sources of oppression. And I'm saying this to equip you to navigate those waters. How will you engage someone like that? Now, in my experience, they're mostly in the ivory towers where I spend most of my time debating one another about these types of things. They're worldview considerations. Most transgender people I know are not adherents of the strong form of this framework. Most are adherents of what I call the weak form of this. The weak form of this framework centers primarily on identity and community. That the transgender community or the broader LGBT community provides them a place and a sense of identity and fellowship and family and community that, frankly, they don't find in the local church. There's something of value to at least reflect on there. Is there a way for my faith community to address questions of identity and community? Or at least would I realize I'd probably have to be a competing family to a group that finds family elsewhere? That's really the pastoral challenge. And I'm not sure that I have the answer for how to do that. I'm going to talk about that in our third hour. Like, here are some things that I do, some strategies that I find helpful. But I want you to at least understand how the three lenses function, which you gravitate towards and why. I gravitate towards the integrity framework for its foundations theologically as an evangelical. It's where I live. But in my practice as a psychologist, I probably draw a lot on the disability framework because I work with people who are not Christians. I work with Christians and non-Christians. And I provide services in the context of a diagnosable disorder in which disability sort of makes sense. But my field is clearly one in which diversity reigns. And this is viewed as a culture to be celebrated. So that's an interesting, those are interesting terrain to navigate. And I would imagine as a pastor, you're facing some of those very same questions. What will it look like for me, for our church, to stand within our community? You could imagine a church saying, well, the best answer is to just say integrity, integrity, integrity. And I know people who mean well, but they shout integrity, integrity, integrity. And they wonder why nobody around them says, you know, thanks for that. I'm convicted. I don't know. We might not agree in a room this size the best response to these dramatically, rapidly changing culture around what is being deconstructed and so on and so forth. I think on the heels of gay marriage, my biggest concern about the transgender issues is it will be treated as just like the gay issue thing. And when social conservatives, of which I am one, when they feel threatened, they tend to sort of double down on and feel cornered and so on and so forth. But I don't think pastors can do that. I think pastors have to pastor in that changing culture and shepherd in that changing culture. So I make sure that I'm, again, as an elder in my church, that I'm shepherding this person, cognizant of a rapidly changing culture around us, but I shepherd you. And my responsibility is ultimately for you before God. So that may help us as a reference point. Okay. So on a couple of summary thoughts here. We don't know what causes gender dysphoria. While gender dysphoria is my primary focus, it's only one of many ways in which someone could come to you and say, I'm transgender. I don't really respond to just cross-dressing behavior. I try to understand its motivation. What's the purpose of it in this person's life? How does it function? What does it look like? That has helped me have a better conversation with some people. It has raised interesting questions in my mind about what is morally permissible and impermissible. Do I say to the woman who wears boxer shorts that that's a moral concern? That's a very culturally constructed thing to say, here's underwear for men. Here's underwear for women. Does the motivation to wear certain clothing matter? What does that look like? Okay, those are things to consider. That's all causation. I'm sorry, that's the causation piece. And then you move into the motivation for cross-dressing. Most cases of gender dysphoria resolve before a child reaches late adolescence or emerging adulthood. We don't have good protocols or data on how to intervene with a child in a way that betters the chances of it resolving on its own. So I can see the appeal of a wait-and-see posture with social support, family support, love for that family, helping them navigate this. Once the dysphoria reaches late adolescence, emerging adulthood, and in most cases it's called early onset, in most cases of what I've described, you'll know this at a young age. Gender identity tends to form between ages 2 and 4. The idea that you're aware of yourself as a boy or a girl occurred at about ages, if you're curious, when did that happen for me? Between ages 2 and 4. So that's usually when gender dysphoria presents itself, because it's an early onset. It's not like a child grew up thinking they were one and then switched. In most cases, about 75% of the cases where it exists, it was early onset. It is possible to have late onset. You say, well, I know somebody who's never had this problem, and they showed up in my office and said, it's occurred in the last year. That can happen. It's just not very common. And we're not sure, does that represent a different expression of it, like a typology? That's hugely debatable right now, our field. That's funny. Can I tell you this one story? I write on gay and lesbian issues a lot, and that's gotten me into a lot of hot water in a lot of places, including the American Psychological Association. But I a colleague of mine stopped me in the hallway a couple years ago and said, "Hey, what are you working on? What are you writing about? What are you publishing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm working on a book on gender dysphoria." And he said, he meant so well, but he didn't have any idea. He said, "Oh, that must be great to kind of get out of the controversies of homosexuality and just be able to take a deep breath and write on something different and kind of new and not have any big debates." And I said, "Yeah, thanks. That's..." And my book came out right when Caitlyn Jenner announced that, you know, Bruce was transitioning to Caitlyn. And it's been quite the firestorm. There's a whole lot of professional and cultural debates right now about all of this. Okay, so in most cases, it's going to be early onset. When it resolves, it's typically the person presents as gay, lesbian, or bisexual. We don't understand those connections. So when I work with families with gender dysphoric children, whether or not it resolves, one of my fundamental questions is, how will you love your child independent of what resolves here? Because this may not resolve, and then you have gender dysphoria through adulthood, an enduring condition in most cases. If it does resolve, you might have a gay, lesbian, or bisexual child. So the idea of how will I love my child, who's probably going to be on the margins of my faith community, or feel like they are, what's that going to look like for me? Those parents need your support and your help. None of that detracts, I think, from your doctrinal position about what's morally permissible and impermissible, where there's clear indications from Scripture about same-sex behavior and so on and so forth. But you can certainly be pastoral and shepherd and compassionate and help them get the resources and support that they need as they navigate that terrain. When you get to adulthood, we're going to talk about what you should do with that. I gave you four pathways. I think there's a better way to think of those today. And even after I wrote my book, I have revisited the pathway model where it resolves, we lose touch with them. It's resolved with their biological sex. They cross-dress intermittently or they do full cross-gender identification. I think there's a better way to think of it, and I'll share it with you in this third hour. So let me see if you have a couple of questions. I think our break's at 10:30 for the second shortest break in conference history. And you just may have more questions at the end of the next one, because then I'll have sort of wrapped it up, tied up with a bow.
Hang on. Our 15-minute break is supposed to be right now. It is 10:30. Then it's my mistake. I'm very sorry. Thank you very much. All right.
I appreciate Greg's efforts to censor the Nebraska guys, but that's fine. Pastorally, I just want to give you a chance to clarify something for me, since you don't have the answer as to how we're going to pastor through this. Thanks for nothing.
It's the third hour.
Yeah.
Stay with me.
All right. So just in your summary statements there, a parent comes to us. Did I hear you say that this person who is dysphoric is going to probably live on the margins, so mom and dad, don't look for the fix? I mean, is that a pastoral? I don't want to put those words in your mouth, but could you clarify maybe that thought you were running with just a little bit?
So I'm taking it to be an older adolescent or an adult who's gender dysphoric. What I'm saying is the data suggest it's not going to resolve on its own. There are no protocols that exist for treating adults for having that gender dysphoria resolve on its own. So it's more like what's it going to look like for this person to live with an enduring condition? And you have other examples from the medical field where someone lives with an enduring condition. And churches are great at loving people and supporting them pastorally with that. If I had a protocol, I would show it to you and say, here, do this with them. The field does not have something. It's probably why the field has been so enamored with hormonal treatment and surgery, is because we haven't had an intervention that resolves this. Now, I'm not in favor of those things, but I'm also not hiding from you a protocol that would help resolve this. So now I think what we're moving towards is a category of, at least for the time being, unless something's developed, is how do I help someone manage their dysphoria? What does it look like to manage with an enduring condition? And that's still pastoral care, right? So some interventions are curative and some are palliative. We're probably looking at palliative care. What does it mean to care for someone with an enduring condition? That doesn't mean I wouldn't pray for a resolution. I wouldn't ask for those things. God is capable of bringing about the miraculous. What I would be very careful with is any way of framing my prayers in a way that puts it on that person's faith or that person's effort, because we don't have a protocol that they're not showing up to do, and I don't know that faith is the measure of the outcome here, any more than I would necessarily want to say that about any other medical condition that you're praying for, or the other issue that you're, you know. I know I treat people with enduring depressive disorders that ebb and flow throughout their lifetime. They are just born with a lower threshold, and they have a great deal of depression that they deal with from time to time. There's great interventions that can help with that, but they're not. It's not always going to be resolved. Or a lower threshold for anxiety or something like that. There's just certain phenomenon and other medical issues that people have that are enduring conditions. In my experience, this is one of those.
Dr. Yarhouse. Is there value for parents and local church communities in trying to speak into the lives of children and adolescents, coaching them, teaching them, mentoring them, and what it means to be a man or a woman? Is there value in that? Does it make a difference? And if that's attempted, what are the essentials that should be focused on so that a too narrow stereotype of man and woman is avoided?
Yeah. So value, when you ask someone like me about the value of doing it, I usually turn to research and say, is there evidence that doing it prevents this from happening? I used to think that there was. I used to think that there was evidence that if you intervened in childhood and did X, Y, and Z, affirming the same gender identity, taking these steps, redirecting towards appropriate interests and so on and so forth was helpful. But I was with a task force this recent last summer looking at all that data, and I was impressed with how little there is, very little empirical evidence that that helps people. And the evidence that was published was of such shoddy quality that I was embarrassed that I brought it to the meeting because it was so bad. So I would say no, there doesn't appear to be that evidence that doing that helps in the prevention. But that's one criteria for, is it a good idea to do it? Is it worth doing it? It may be just worth doing it because that's maybe what our field says in terms of, does it stop this from happening? I don't know that it's going to be preventable, but I would still want to raise children with a sense of what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman. I think the challenge pastorally is how much of that is biblical and how much of that is cultural. So many of our teachings about being a man and being a woman are remarkably reflective of the culture in which we reside. And I think I'd want to be just cautious about what is it exactly that is biblical. What do we know from Scripture? And I don't know that what we know from Scripture is the only thing you can teach someone. You can also teach in our culture some things that you value that are important. But what if your child doesn't have those interests? The risk is that them not having those interests is now thought of as not being biblical. That's what I want to avoid. I remember in my introduction, I was an art major, right? I majored in art. My mother did art. My grandmother did art. I love the creativity of art. In some settings in our culture, in some places, doing art would not be something a boy would do, right? That's not biblical. It's clearly cultural. You could imagine parenting someone with some interest like that, and it creates that rigid category. So I don't know that I have a curriculum for what that looks like. I think we should teach those things. I like a book by Stan and Brenda Jones, my mentor, How and When to Tell Your Kids About Sex. And it's about sexual character formation and addresses things like homosexuality, gender identity. I want to affirm a child's gender identity. But when their interests are maybe gender atypical, I don't want to be so reactive to that that it makes them think they can't possibly now be a boy or possibly be a girl because their interests aren't the same as dad's. If I was really, you know, rough, kind of a man's man, that's the way we talk about that, and my child wasn't, I wouldn't want that contrast to mean then you're not a man, right? So those are things that I see those mistakes made more in youth groups than I do other places, but I think it's a good correction.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the EFCA Theology Podcast. You can find more episodes by searching EFCA Theology Podcast in any podcast app or on the web at efca.org/podcast.